Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. Today, we've got a story of a man who saw things that most of us couldn't see. A detective on a particularly tricky case who was watching criminals multiply like fruit flies while the people under attack were mostly oblivious. Mark Goodman ended up at the FBI as their futurist in residence. But the problem was that the criminals he was stalking weren't from the future. And like brilliant art thieves or cat burglars, they got inside without anyone realizing it. Mark Goodman is the author of Future Crimes. Everything is connected, everyone is vulnerable, and what we can do about it. Great to have you here.
The pleasure's mine.
You seem to make the case that Silicon Valley has built kind of this big playground for all of us to, you know, listen to music and get the news and collaborate and find our next job. But then the doors were flung open to this playground, and some of the people who walked through were not all that great. Do you feel like we're mostly kind of blissfully unaware of that?
The fact that there are mean kids in the schoolyard?
Yeah.
I think so. And I first want to agree with your main point, which is that all of this tech can be awesome, right? It makes our life simpler, easier, more connected, provides tremendous benefit to everyone and in our daily lives. And that's why people enjoy it so much. And that's why it's so addictive. But there is a downside that I think people are definitely neglecting, and they need to be aware of some of those risks. And that's what I'm trying to do, is raise awareness of those.
We do have this unending parade of news about people's identities being stolen and credit cards being hacked from store accounts. I wonder if companies get to the point where they're like, look, we need to do business online and we need to let individuals have accounts with us. And, you know, they just cross their fingers and hope for the best.
Let's just take it out of the world of cybersecurity for a second, right? You know, we all know that you should exercise, you should eat right, limit the amount of sugar, you should sleep, you should work out. We know all of those things, and yet sometimes we make other choices. But we know what physical security looks like in the real world. We don't walk down that very dark alley in the bad part of town, right? There are certain places we choose not to travel when there's a war that's breaking out there. The same is true in cyberspace. Yes, it is a difficult task, and there is a lot to be done, but it is the simple things that people seem to be messing up. Let's take a look at the Anthem Blue Cross breach that occurred. 80 million patient records stolen, you know, in the last year. That was a massive data breach. That data was not encrypted. Why? Because the law didn't require it. It was kind of difficult and expensive, so they just didn't bother. And as a result of that lack of encryption, people were able to get access to all of the underlying data. So we're not talking about really sophisticated steps that people need to take. It comes down to the basics. And in the same way you would apply the basics to your physical safety or to your physical health, the same is true in cyberspace. And those few steps can make a massive difference.
Take me into the world of these criminals. What are they like? How organized are they? Are they mostly just, you know, independent men or women sitting in their basement? Like, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, a few years ago, I wrote an article for the Harvard Business Review called Lessons in Innovation from the Criminal Underground: What Legitimate Business Can Learn from Organized Crime. And it turns out that a lot of these, you know, organized crime groups are quite that. They are extremely organized, and they are using all the latest business techniques that you would actually read in the Harvard Business Review. So they are doing crowdsourcing, they're doing crowdfunding, they're doing lean startups, on-demand pricing, they have price fluctuations. They offer tech support for other criminals when they're hired. So there was a few cases that I've told the stories about. One company was called Innovative Marketing Solutions, based out of Ukraine. Their business model was to create antivirus software. And when people would receive a pop-up on their computer, said, you know, warning, virus, and they tried to click out of that pop-up, they couldn't get this big red screen off of their computer. So they were forced to download for $49. You know, Malware Destructor was the name of the product, and people paid $49 on their credit card. They downloaded the antivirus program and the problem went away. But what they didn't realize is that Innovative Marketing Solutions was a criminal organization and folks weren't downloading antivirus as much as they were downloading virus. And what they also didn't realize is they had just given their credit card numbers to organized crime. From the consumer's perspective, it looked completely legit, right? Innovative Marketing Solutions issued receipts. They had 800 numbers that people could call around the world in French, Spanish, Italian. The FBI, working with Interpol, came and investigated them, and because Innovative Marketing had issued receipts for the, you know, malicious software that they sold,
right,
the FBI totaled it up and saw that they did over $500 million worth of business in just 3 years.
That's incredible to me that there's that kind of infrastructure. And it sounds like they're pretty impressive to you with their skill and their organization.
They had tech support. They had like an org chart where they had SEO specialists, HR. What would HR do? These are the people that would go out and recruit more criminals to come in to the organization. They had a CFO. What would the CFO do? Everything that a normal CFO would do, plus money laundering, right? And by all accounts, it was a great place to work for criminals. They had employees of the month. They had retreats where they would go to a local lake in Ukraine. They would do rope exercises, team training exercises. So these organizations are quite sophisticated. They even gamified the workplace. The crime boss running it offered contests, like they were offering Ferraris or a suitcase with 50,000 euros in it for the criminal that could come up with the best scam or the best malware.
Now, the way you're describing it, with retreats and a really nice office to work at, it sounds to me like these are not people who are scared of being discovered. Or am I wrong about that?
No, you're right. They have nothing to fear from the police, broadly speaking. With no disrespect to my friends and colleagues in law enforcement, that's my legacy, that's my own background. But in effect, what most folks haven't realized is that the internet broke policing. International law is a very slow and lumbering process. And the fact is that a New York City police officer can't make an arrest in Moscow and vice versa. And yet the criminals can cross border after border in a matter of seconds. And so we have these two completely distinct systems that do not overlap. And while it's true that the FBI and other police agencies around the world have put together some very significant and impressive cases, their workload is really hard because in the same way, you know, in the 80s and 90s, we had money laundering havens, whether it was in Switzerland or Caribbean islands. Well, the same is very much true with cybercrime. People broadly don't operate the largest cybercrime rings from Washington, D.C., right, or London. They are operated from jurisdictions where rule of law is very weak and, you know, government officials are on the take.
Were these people who operate these criminal franchises, were they always criminals? I mean, were they like jewel thieves and now they're you know, data thieves? Or were they like law-abiding farmers and now they're data thieves?
As you're telling the story, it brings up a funny picture of like people that were working at Ford and the factory gets downsized. So like at the jewel thief factory, people have to go through retraining before.
Right.
You know, times are changing. You need to become a cyber criminal today. So no, I don't think it was quite that formal. But what you do see is a massive overlap in skill sets. So people have a vision of hackers as being the 17-year-old kid in his mom's basement hacking away at all hours of the night, kind of the Matthew Broderick character in the movie War Games. But as it turns out, cyber criminals are getting much older and they're affiliating themselves with organized crime. So Rand Institute did a study that showed that 40% of cyber criminals are above the age of 35 and 80% of criminal hackers are affiliated with an organized crime group.
What's interesting to me about some of the stuff that you've written, though, is that the motivation for some of these people, some of them, is not money, which I think runs counter to what we tend to believe about online criminals, which is mostly they're in this camp of like they're trying to charge an extra $19.95 onto your credit card without you noticing or whatever.
No, there are many people who are motivated for things other than money. If you look at, you know, what some people would define as cyber criminals, the WikiLeaks organizations, the anonymous organizations, the LulzSec and the like, many people, you know, put them solidly in the bucket of criminal hackers. And while it's true, they broadly violate the law of many countries around the world, sometimes they hack with a purpose. This type of subset is of folks who play in this world are known as hacktivists. And these are people who are hacking for a political purpose or the like. So they may go after a government that they don't like. Previously, Anonymous had targeted Sony because of their policies. They did not enjoy certain policies that Sony had unleashed regarding digital rights management of their software. So Anonymous took them on, and Anonymous has even taken on child pornographer groups. So while you may not like Anonymous hacking Sony, they recently penetrated an underground cyber child pornography organization, and they revealed the names and addresses of all the people that were trading in child sexual abuse images. That's an interesting, odd development that makes them hard to put in one category or another.
We are entering a time when people can control their thermostats, right, with their smartphones. So you can be like, I'm coming home now, you know, let's turn the air conditioning on, kind of thing. People are going to be able to turn on their washing machines remotely. Obviously, a lot of people already have Roombas, those robots that will vacuum your floor.
Yes.
Does that set us up for kind of a scary future?
The Roomba kills you while you sleep.
Something
like that. Yes, if your Roomba starts grabbing knives out of the kitchen, be afraid. I mean, again, there's tremendous convenience in all of this. You talked about being able to, you know, change your thermostat. Everything is going online now, and the Internet of Things is going to be massive. You know, you can start your car remotely. You can open up your garage door remotely, turn on music, play, you know, turn on the fountains or the sprinklers in your backyard, all of that. But once your car is online, that means that you're not the only one who can access it. People can hack it. People have hacked cars. We had the case of the Jeep Cherokee that was just hacked, leading to the largest technological recall in the nation's history due to a computer hacking of a vehicle. So that is serious and that's real. And we think, you know, we have so many technological devices in our lives now, but we are vastly expanding the size of the internet. Today's internet is about the size of a golf ball, but tomorrow's is going to be the size of the sun. That means that every pet, plate, prisoner, elevator, car, pacemaker, every physical device in our world will be connected to the internet one way or another. You know, we look around our daily lives today and we think, wow, we're living at some technological pinnacle because I can have a Nest thermostat in my house and I can have GPS in my car and I can play Xbox, you know, gaming, Call of Duty against other people across the internet. And we think, wow, we're so technologically advanced. The fact of the matter is, we are just living in the first seconds of the first minutes of the first hours of the internet revolution, and we have no idea what's coming next.
And yet, I think that most people, even who hear this conversation, may listen, may care, and yet mostly they're going to shrug and be like, yeah, but my data, it's pretty secure. My company, I think they've got it together. And they're not going to do that much. Why is that? Why do we mostly have that sort of, oh, well, what are you going to do about it kind of reaction?
I mean, I understand what you're saying and I understand where you're coming from. And I certainly understand why people would feel like that. I hope they will act differently. Let's deconstruct it. We live in a world, you know, with this 24/7 news cycles where we hear today terrorists are going to kill us, cyber attacks are going to kill us, global warming is going to kill us, you know, ET is going to kill us, robots are going to kill us. And it gets overwhelming because as you look about your daily life, there's so much beauty in this world. And so, you know, you have your kids, your family, your pets, whatever it is, there's a lot to enjoy, right? There's a lot of beautiful things on this planet. And yet there are risks. I think for people that watch the news and they see cyber attack, you know, Sony hacked, Home Depot attacked, JP Morgan hacked, OPM hacked,
right,
it can seem overwhelming.
Right.
And I think that apathy is our enemy here. You can't protect yourself against, you know, a ray gun from the planet Pluto that comes in and fries your hard drive, right? We're not trying to protect against that. Right. But basic encryption in a corporation, that's something that's easy to fix, right? Not having your password be the word password and using it for all your logins. 70% of people use the same password across multiple accounts. That's a key to failure, and there are tools that can help protect you against that. So don't believe the hype. There are things that you can do to protect yourself, your family, your company, and even your country, and that's what I hope people will do. Take those steps.
Last question. Do you feel like the attitude of both Silicon Valley and the government is changing when it comes to really thinking hard about cyber threats?
Not so much. I would say slightly. And from a Silicon Valley perspective, here's what we're seeing. They are making slight changes in the products that they're producing to slightly think slightly more about privacy and security. Where you see the real movement in Silicon Valley is funding cybersecurity companies. So there are tons of financial opportunities for investors who are putting their money into companies into the cybersecurity realm. We have our first ETF that tracks the cybersecurity space. Their symbol is HACK, H-A-C-K, right? So there are investment opportunities for people that are working to solve these problems. But broadly, for the device manufacturers, all the internet startups that are collecting your data because that's their business model, whether it be, you know, Facebook or OkCupid, right? They make money. They give away their so-called free products and make money by collecting and sharing your data with advertisers and data brokers. So that's not going to change. That's fundamental. The government, I don't see much of a change at all. In the wake of the Sony hack, the president announced a 30-day cybersecurity sprint. All right. I'm sorry, in the wake of the OPM hack that occurred. And I really don't see too much change on the ground. What companies in Silicon Valley and the U.S. government lack is any sense of intentionality. Let's go back in history to World War II, when the Allies also faced an existential threat, that time from the Nazis getting access to nuclear weapons before the Allies did. In response, the U.S. government, working with its allies, created the Manhattan Project. They had over 120,000 people working around the clock trying to solve that problem, to deal with the existential threat that the West faced in those days. We too face an existential threat today, not from an exploding nuclear weapon per se, but from the technological tools we have in our lives being used against us, and particularly attacks against critical infrastructures, everything from financial services to the electrical grid itself. The difference between the Allies and World War II is that they were intentional about solving the threat that they faced in their lifetime, and we are not. Until we're intentional, until we move away from box-checking exercises inside corporations and the government, we're never going to make the big differences that are required to have the benefits of all of these wonderful technologies that are being introduced into the world today.
Mark Goodman has been the futurist in residence at the FBI. He was a senior advisor to Interpol. His most recent book is Future Crimes. Everything is connected, everyone is vulnerable, and what we can do about it. Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Go to our website, innovationhub.org, to learn more about this week's guests and to comment on today's segments. You'll get even more information on our Facebook page, facebook.com/innovationhubradio. From PRI and WGBH Radio, I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub.